Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've heard it over and over again. We had to throw all that money at the banks because tight credit threatened us all. Well, credit is still tight, although the Treasury Secretary reports it's loosening up a little. And another argument for the bailout, that the banks were too big to fail? Today, some top economists were asking, oh yeah, says who? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear unique perspectives on global events and American culture at americanpublicmedia.org/poetry.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday, the 21st day of April. On a day that top economists were telling Congress to go ahead and let the big financial institutions fail, Wall Street chose to focus on the testimony at another Capitol Hill hearing. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner indicated most banks now have sufficient reserves on hand to cover possible future losses. He defended the agency's $700 billion bank rescue plan, and he said the government's bailout fund still has enough money to cover future needs. But even as the Treasury Secretary was speaking, several of the nation's large regional banks issued worse-than-expected earnings. As Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports, that raises questions about whether more banks will need more government help in the future.
The books of regional banks, such as U.S. Bank Corp, Comerica, and M&T Bank, aren't clogged with the sorts of risky securities that drag down larger investment banks. But with their customers hit by unemployment and foreclosures, these smaller banks are beginning to feel the same sort of pain. Last week, bigger banks reported better-than-expected profits. Some analysts were skeptical, pointing to accounting gimmicks and one-time events. Christopher Whalen with Institutional Risk Analytics says the finances of smaller banks are looking a lot worse.
The regional banks are actually being more honest and more righteous in many respects than their larger brethren. The regionals are showing you what's going on, which is that it's a tough time.
With profits at some regional banks falling between 60 and 90%, Scott Valentin at FBR Capital Markets doesn't rule out the need for future government help.
With further home price declines probably in the next couple quarters, unemployment going up in the Southeast, it presents a very challenging environment for these banks.
On the other hand, Christopher Whalen says smaller banks should bounce back more quickly than the large investment banks.
The little community banks with good funding that don't have a lot of complex securities on their balance sheets, once they get through this particular crunch this year, and it will probably go through the whole year, they're going to be very good value.
But not necessarily before they call on the government for some help weathering the storm. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
For all the positive spin the Treasury Secretary was giving Congress about the bank bailout today, there was a counterpoint from the man charged with rooting out fraud and abuse in the program. Special Inspector General Neil Barshofsky released a 250-page report. And as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, the watchdog office has already launched 20 criminal investigations.
Neil Barofsky is looking into a wide range of allegations of abuse, everything from insider trading in the $700 billion bank bailout to allegations of fraud in the mortgage modification program.
I am skeptical.
Bert Ely's a banking consultant.
I think we need to see a lot more in the way of specifics and details.
Several analysts say that major banks, already on the ropes and dependent on the government for their survival, would have to be nuts to risk breaking the law. But Bill Black, a former bank regulator and law professor, believes that the public-private partnership designed to help investors buy troubled assets from banks could be a disaster in the making.
The TARP II program is a complete invitation to fraud and abuse.
And the Special Inspector General, Neil Barofsky, seems to share some of these concerns. He says the program is, quote, inherently vulnerable to fraud and collusion between investors. So how would that work?
A cash-for-trash scheme.
Black worries that Bank A could agree to buy Bank B's bad assets at inflated prices if Bank B returned the favor. Normally, that would be nuts.
Except that I, of course, don't have to put up my own money.
They'd borrow it from taxpayers instead, and if the assets lose value, they don't have to pay back the loans. So Black says banks, by working together, could get high prices for bad assets and leave taxpayers with the bill. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
As for those economists I mentioned up top, they were talking to another group of lawmakers who were looking at the health of the financial sector today, the Joint Economic Committee in Congress. The focus was size and what criteria we should use to determine if a large financial institution, say an AIG, is too big to fail. Two notable economists weighed in, as did the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, and they all said we should break up big financials and maybe even use antitrust laws to do it. To talk about this latter point, we turn to Zephyr Teachout. She's a law professor at Duke University. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I have to say that I've been scratching my head for quite a while now, wondering why the words antitrust haven't been a bigger part of this too-big-to-fail conversation. Why not, do you think?
Historically, our antitrust policy is not set up to deal with the kind of financial and political crisis that we have now. That isn't to say it couldn't be, but it's been primarily focused on mergers that threaten the quality of the product and the consumer experience.
So why not antitrust in the case of an institution, financial institution, that is said to be too big to fail?
Well, several people now are calling for an overhaul of our antitrust framework. Simon Johnson, who was an economist at the IMF and now a professor at MIT, talked about this today in the congressional hearings, and others have as well. It's a framework that already exists. So if we strengthen those laws, it could be used to break up the existing, if not monopolies, but overly large companies in banking industry and elsewhere.
So how do you augment these antitrust laws to apply to the banks?
You could pass a new act which would join the other antitrust law acts, Clayton and Sherman acts. This new law would look at size as an independent variable. That could be a combination of looking at profit, assets, or market value, but would have a default rule that says no company can become larger than a certain size depending on the industry.
Well, let me take the other side of this issue. There's an argument that bigger is better when it comes to these financial institutions because they can offer more to consumers and might in the end become more efficient. What do you say to that?
Well, if you saw the panel at the Congress this morning, congressional panel on the economy, there was a consensus that a truly vibrant and stable and innovative economy actually depends upon medium-sized businesses, small businesses, and the banking sector, a mix of medium-sized banks and community banks. That's also true for a vibrant democracy. Now, that isn't to say that there isn't going to be some cost, something lost if we create a scale-based antitrust. But I think collectively we're willing to take that risk. Democracy is worth it. And economies of scale, which work decently in some areas in the private market, economies of scale work far too well when it comes to influencing government.
The difference between economies of scale and economies of overscale, huh?
Right, exactly. There's a wonderful argument out there that a colleague of mine has been writing about. It's not just that these banks are too big to fail, but they're too big to manage by anyone, too big to understand. And if we don't understand the instruments we've created, well, then we should encourage institutions that we can manage and can understand.
Zephyr Teachout is a law professor at Duke University. Thanks for your insights.
Thank you.
As we mentioned, Wall Street gave a new vote of confidence to financial shares today. In other words, today the seesaw was up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama is back home from his second major tour abroad. He huddled with fellow leaders at the G20 gathering in Europe and at the Summit of the Americas in Trinidad. His performance on international issues and what some are calling a realignment of our foreign policy has gotten mixed reviews. But one thing is clear in this global economy. The foreign policy team in the Obama administration needs to factor economics into nearly every decision. Commentator Dan Dresner says America used to have people who understood that connection, but not anymore.
I heard a shocking confession at a recent conference about international relations. A high-profile commentator was asked about the dispute between the United States and European Union over fiscal stimulus. The pundit replied that he did not understand anything going on in the economy. It was not surprising that he failed to grasp the issue. What was shocking was that he said it out loud. The dirty little secret inside the Beltway is that international economics either scares or bores America's foreign policy community. Although foreign affairs analysts understand on some level that economics is important, they see it as distinct from geopolitics. As a result, very few of them have the necessary experience or training to talk about international economic matters. It was not always this way. During the Cold War, some of America's greatest foreign policy minds, Dean Acheson, Walt Rostow, George Shultz, and James Baker, had substantive backgrounds in economics, finance, or business. This allowed them to navigate the waters between high politics and high finance with a minimum of fuss. More specialization has left fewer foreign policy professionals and commentators with the capacity to talk about economics. This knowledge divorce can have bad long-term effects on American diplomacy. During the Asian financial crisis, for example, State Department officials provided minimal input into the conditions attached to IMF rescue packages because few people at Foggy Bottom fully understood the problems. The result was a series of onerous and intrusive bargains that left a residue of resentment across the Pacific Rim. Foreign policy wonks like to talk about high politics and low politics, and they usually relegate economic diplomacy into the latter category. In these times, however, economics is foreign policy. The United States is embroiled in a transatlantic dispute over fiscal policy. China and Russia are proposing that the dollar be replaced as the world's reserve currency. India is upset over U.S. criticisms about offshore outsourcing. These disputes can bleed over into the meat and potatoes of international security. America needs a continuing education program for its foreign policy community, and the first course they should take is Economics 101.
Daniel Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. His most recent book is called All Politics is Global. Your thoughts are always welcome at marketplace.org. South Africans start heading to the polls in a few hours. The ruling African National Congress is widely expected to win the election. It's been the party in control since apartheid ended in 1994. Back then, Nelson Mandela's new government made a pledge to redistribute 30% of white-owned farmland to the black majority. But it's still a long way from that goal, and now the government is threatening to take back land it's given to black farmers. Gretchen Wilson reports.
Sibongile Simelane grew up in this crowded shanty town, Duduza, about 80 miles outside of Johannesburg. Jobs were scarce, but she and her friends were determined to escape the streets and start a farming business.
It became a dream for us.
For decades, black South Africans were kicked off their ancestral land and then barred from owning property. But when apartheid ended, there was black majority rule, and the government set up a reform policy to distribute land to aspiring black farmers. 3 years ago, Simelane and her partners got the lease on a 400-acre farm.
It was amazing to have a farm. I was very, very excited, and I was nervous.
Researchers say about half of the new black-owned farms have failed. Now the government is threatening to evict black farmers who don't make the most of their land. The policy is meant to reassure voters that South Africa won't go the way of neighboring Zimbabwe, where corrupt and inefficient land redistribution almost wiped out commercial farming. But many South Africans say the confiscation policy is harsh, and they're furious at the ruling ANC party for what they see as the slow pace of land reform.
We believe that the dream that many people sacrifice for has not been realized and is continuously being compromised.
Andile Ndama is an activist with the Landless People's Movement. He calls the new policy racist because it only threatens the land rights of blacks. White farmers, who didn't get the land under the recent redistribution policy, can be as unproductive as they like.
It's an apartheid. We have sustained the apartheid system in many, many areas of life. So for me personally, I'm unhappy to the extent that I'll not be voting, in fact, in this coming election.
Critics across the political spectrum blame the government for the collapse of these new farms. The hopeful farmers are often lumped together in a group and given lots of land but little training. Many can't get bank loans to buy tractors, fertilizers, and seeds. Theo de Jager is with AgriSA, a coalition of 70,000 mostly white commercial farmers.
Very often the beneficiaries of land reform get the poorest of the farms, and they are delivered to failure.
So AgriSA set up a mentorship program where farmers can work together across the racial divide. Andre Bota is a farmer who developed the program.
What the local farmers said is, we can't wait for government. Let's assist these young black people to make a success of their businesses.
Sibongile Simelane is part of this program, and so far her 400 acres are going strong. She and her eight partners raise hundreds of sheep, cattle, and chickens. A neighboring farmer comes over a few times a week to teach them the basics.
I've learned how to vaccinate. I've learned how to keep records of our mortality and our live sheep.
Simelane wants mentoring projects like this one to reach others like her, and she hopes that after the election, government will stop making threats and instead boost its support for emerging black farmers. In rural South Africa, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Coming up, leaner paychecks mean lower prices.
I was starting to hear about people losing their jobs. And at that point, I began to realize that my fees, which had been quite within the range of normal the year before, were beginning to be high for some people.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 127 points, or 1 2/3%, to finish at 7969. The Nasdaq rose 35 points, or 2 1/4%, to close at 1643. The S&P 500 edged up 17 points, or 2 1/10%, to end the day at 850. We mentioned the Geithner boost for financials. Bank of America and J.P. Morgan each added more than 9% to share prices. Citigroup and Wells Fargo each tacked on more than 10%. Yahoo said it will cut costs by cutting 5% of its workforce. The internet search company's shares climbed 5 1/4%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap in marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a House subcommittee on aviation discusses helicopter emergency medical services. The focus is on issues related to safety and regulation. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee holds a hearing titled Global Climate Change, U.S. Leadership for a New Global Agreement. And a toast to the planet we live on. Tomorrow is Earth Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. Have you tried talking the boss into a first-class upgrade lately? Apparently, it's a travel perk few can afford these days. United Airlines reports a $382 million loss in the first quarter of the year, and it blames much of that on a 30% drop in first and business class travel. Low-cost carriers like Southwest, on the other hand, don't have first class, and that's helped them somewhat during this recession. But as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports, the big legacy carriers like American, Delta, and United are now feeling the downside of upper-class travel.
A typical first-class cabin only has about 10% of a flight's seats, but a full first class can bring in 40% of the flight's ticket revenue.
In times of strong demand, the first-class and business-class tickets do drive a disproportionate amount of revenues and profits for the airline.
That's industry analyst Matthew Jacob. In bad times, he says, an emptier first class means disproportionate losses. So what's the solution? Ernest Arvey is a veteran airline consultant. He says some carriers are already dropping first-class cabins in favor of an expanded business class.
For most people, business class is the new first class. It's got really all of the amenities, in fact, more amenities than first class used to have.
But business class isn't immune from recessions either. In the last several years, three all-business class airlines started service from the U.S. to London. All three went out of business. Still, Webster O'Brien with the aviation consulting firm SH&E says don't expect all airlines to go all economy.
Different carriers focus on different segments of the market. We've actually watched a number of international long-haul carriers try to enter in that segment alone, only to find that it's not sustainable.
O'Brien says things may look bleak for first class right now, but there will always be some demand for a premium product.
You know, is Tiffany's dead? Is Bulgari dead? Is Rolls-Royce dead? No. And have they been around for a long time? Have they been through multiple cycles? Yes.
He says this is just the latest chapter in the never-ending struggle to get the airline's cabin balance right. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
OPEC is getting anxious about oil prices. A barrel of crude is still below $50, and Iran's oil minister complained today that countries are stockpiling more oil. But the biggest reason for declining prices is weak demand. People aren't driving as much as they used to. Industry isn't using as much fuel. And that's causing an oversupply. And yes, that leads to stockpiling. As Tamara Keith reports, crude inventories here in the U.S. are at their highest levels now since 1990.
Oil inventories include all the crude sitting in pipelines and storage tanks just waiting to be refined. And there's a lot of it sitting around right now.
It's a symptom of our current economic recession.
Ron Planting is an economist at the American Petroleum Institute. He says as weak demand pushes down prices, some companies are stocking up on what appears to be bargain oil.
That's what it looks like to me, that there's a lot of crude oil on the world market, and some companies think it's a good time to buy it and hold it for later.
The Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, has cut its output to try and deal with the oversupply. But Gene McGillion, an analyst with Tradition Energy, says the cuts haven't had their intended effect yet.
They have begun to start to work their way. It's just that the drop in consumer demand has kind of outpaced that.
And while oil producers may see excess inventory as a problem, for consumers, it can mean less pain at the pump. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
All right, I'm cheap. Cheap, cheap. Cheap. There's always a nagging worry that if I paid full price, I paid too much. We're getting pretty used to seeing discounts these days on everything from clothes to cars to fancy vacations. Almost makes you wonder, does anyone pay full price for anything anymore? Well, they do, of course, but not often. The discount list keeps getting longer, and you might be surprised to find out what's on it. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Robin Foreman is a psychologist in Manhattan. She spends most of her time working with children. Last summer, she noticed their well-heeled parents were becoming anxious about money.
I was starting to hear about people losing their jobs. And at that point, I began to realize that my fees, which had been quite within the range of normal the year before, were beginning to be high for some people. And I felt that the time had come to lower them.
Foreman cut her fees for new clients by 10%, and if they hesitate when she quotes her price, she knocks off another 6 to 8%. She says many of her colleagues are doing the same thing. Lawyers are also under pressure to cut their fees, but they've been more reluctant to tinker with their sacred system of billing. Joel Henning is with Hildebrandt, management consultants for the legal profession.
The incentives in the law firm are to pile it on, and to put as many people on a case as possible, and to bill for their time on an hourly basis.
Or as Gene Hackman's character put it in The Firm.
Everything depends on billing. How many hours you spend even thinking about a client. I don't care if you're stuck in traffic or
shaving or sitting on a park bench.
Okay, Joel Henning says that's a slight exaggeration. But he says traditionally big law firms have had little incentive to be efficient or cost-effective. And in a good economy, few clients complained. But lately, they've begun pushing back. And law firms have begun cutting back, in some cases lowering hourly rates or charging flat fees.
They will offer to handle, for example, all of the litigation of a company for a fixed fee, or all of the labor and employment matters for a fixed fee. And I think we're moving towards that kind of a model, although very slowly.
Cash-strapped companies don't want to pay the usual rates for their marketing efforts either. So some ad agencies are also reducing fees or switching to a pay-for-performance pricing model. These tactics may help businesses hold on to clients now, but what happens when the economy recovers and they want to bring prices back up? Tom Mavis is a marketing professor at New York University. He says businesses will have to raise fees gradually to keep clients from walking. He says customers are happy when a price falls, still.
When you raise it back up, this causes negative change, but that negative reaction is much stronger than your initial positive reaction.
He says the brain is hardwired to respond more strongly to bad news than good, so consumers will sulk when a price goes up and all but forget the unexpected bargain they got when it dropped. Mavis says one way for businesses to keep their options open is to manage expectations.
I mean, you can try to make sure that you lower your rate without affecting the long-term reference price by making it seem like an exception. You know, it's a recession special.
Psychologist Robin Foreman says she'll be ready to take her special off the menu as soon as she gets her cue.
If things begin to turn around and people start sounding like they've got much more disposable income, then I will raise my fees too. You know, I don't want to be the last person on the block to make a living.
She's waiting until clients start packing kids off to camp again and hitting the beaches of Europe. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, a nod to tomorrow's 39th observance of Earth Day. The plastic bag industry has announced plans aimed at heading off moves by retailers to drop their product and a trend by some cities to outlaw their use. Plastic bag makers say they'll use 40% recycled content, but it'll take them another 6 years to reach that goal. To which the Worldwide Earth Day Network says, thanks, but no thanks. The head of the environmental advocacy group says the better alternative is not using them at all. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 127 points, 1 2/3%. The Nasdaq gained 35 points, 2 1/4%. The S&P 500 added 13 points, 1.5%. Thanks to Rada Bead, Jennifer Collins, Renita Jablonski, and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. Next time on the program, free class materials for fifth graders. Great, right?
And then I get to the paragraph saying, and this is funded by Old Spice deodorant and Always Feminine products.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can come back and join Kai for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.